Welcome to the CERT podcast series, Security for Business Leaders. The CERT division is part of the Software Engineering Institute, a federally funded research and development center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You can find out more about us at CERT.org. Show notes for today's conversation are available at the podcast website. My name is Lisa Young. I'm a member of the CERT Cyber Risk Management team. I'm pleased to welcome Sean Sweeney. Sean is the Information Security Officer for the University of Pittsburgh. Today, we will be discussing Sean's use of the NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, cybersecurity framework for helping manage his organization's cybersecurity risks. Welcome to the podcast series, Sean.
Thanks, Lisa, and I'm glad to be here and really looking forward to the opportunity to speak to you and eventually the audience about what we've been doing with the NIST CSF here at Pitt.
Thank you. So on that note, would you give us a brief overview of the risk environment at the University of Pittsburgh?
Sure. Higher ed, especially a research institution of our size, is kind of a different beast than I think most consider, and it does present some challenges when it comes to securing an environment like this. The university itself, just to kind of set the stage, we have approximately 35,000 students and another 13,000 faculty and staff. They're spread across five campuses, but most of them are here in our Pittsburgh campus in Oakland. Universities, by their very nature, are largely decentralized beasts. I often say I'm not the CISO of a corporation, I'm the CISO of a city-state, because we really are, it's up to 60 different organizations under the same umbrella, and, we have facilities, we have the business units, we have the academic units, those that are doing research, so on and so forth. Some of the things that make that challenging beyond, what I just said would be higher ed, we're a target-rich environment. First and foremost, since we're a research institution, the size and speed of our network is just amazing. Honestly, it was one of the first things that kind of struck me when I first came here almost 3 years ago. We're built for large data transfers, lots of nodes on the network. I have 300,000 endpoints on my network at any given time.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot to keep track of. It certainly is. And then you throw on top of that just the whole collaborative nature of research and academia in general. The whole idea of like academic freedom runs completely contrary to the black and white security of. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that's a lot of diversity. A lot of different kinds of things you have to deal with. So that city-state is appropriate moniker.
And that's absolutely true. And the other thing, and you just hit on it right there, is the diversity not just in the different groups here, but what comes out of that is the diversity in the information that they're working with, right? I used to often joke with some friends here in town that were in security at a local financial institution that their job was a lot easier than mine because their network was built to do one thing, and that's facilitate financial transactions. My network's built to do 200 different things. We've got some very traditional business units that you would find in the corporate arena. We've got the CFO's office that does all the accounting, the general ledger, all that type of stuff. You have admissions and financial aid. You have the registrar's office. You have student financials, very, academic specific, but still business functions. But then you throw in, we've got health sciences, we've got engineering, we've got social science research going on, all of which may have their own intricacies, their own different definitions of what is sensitive. And then throw on top of that, most of that work's being done under grants or contracts, which may or may not come with their own security language.
So, right. Well, that's definitely a target-rich environment. So then how did you first become aware of the NIST cybersecurity framework, and what made you think it would address, the diversity of your risk management and cybersecurity needs?
Sure. I had been familiar with the various publications from NIST when I first got here, because one of the first things we had to do is, because we receive a lot of contracts from federal agencies like NIH, we were seeing some flow-down language specific to FISMA. So we had got involved with, the 853 series document from NIST. And then our chancellor retired and they had selected the new chancellor who happened to be the former director of NIST, which obviously got my attention. And then we saw the publication come out, I believe it was February 2014. Prior to that, the president had issued an executive order and a policy directive kind of setting the stage for the critical infrastructure and setting the stage for NIST to create this document. So when it came out, just quite frankly, we were very interested in, you know, even if just from an academic point of view, kind of seeing what it was. And then when we dug into it, obviously it seemed like it would fit the environment, being that we're so diverse here, you know, trying to shoehorn frameworks here in the past had always been something that was difficult, and the framework seemed to offer us the flexibility to kind of do so.
Right, that's a great thing. So then talking about that framework, can you say how did you get started on using the framework?
Sure. So the first thing is the framework itself. I should take a step back and kind of talk about the framework, how it's designed, and then that, 'cause that flows into how we used it.
Sure.
So the framework consists of 5 core functions, and they're identity, protect, detect, respond, and recover, right? So those 5 functions are broken down into categories and then subcategories. An example of a category would be asset management. An example of the first asset management subcategory, I believe off the top of my head it says hardware and systems will be inventoried, right? So it's like a control, but it's not prescriptive as much as it is descriptive. So you've got that core, and then there's also this concept of these implementation tiers, and they'll actually come into play when I talk a little bit later about how we use this at the university. But those are risk tiers, and they're because the whole point of the framework is to measure your program and also inform risk. But the real meat of the work that happens with the framework is taking those core functions, categories, and subcategories, and then creating what's called a current profile.
Please tell us about the profile and how that applied to your environment.
Okay. So when you work with these, we'll call them the subcategories, you take all of those and you compare them to your environment. You basically go through and take these descriptive, I'll call them controls for lack of a better term, but they're really not control objectives, but you take these broad
practices, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I would say they're more like practices you would want to do in a framework that would sort of set the stage for controls as well as other activities, right?
Exactly. And in fact, the subcategories actually do map to specific controls from various standards like COBIT, ISO, 853, so on and so forth. So you go through this current profile exercise, and it's you write down how you're doing, how you're meeting all of these kind of descriptive practices. I had to work with, you know, not just my security team, because we were doing it from, we're central IT here at the university, so we were doing it from an enterprise level, although that's kind of misleading because universities are so decentralized. You know, we are in charge of the enterprise applications and the network, which is, you know, an enterprise service, but we don't control all of the endpoints. So we were just doing it phase one from our point of view, those things that we did control. So I worked with other directors in our IT group, and filled out this current profile. Then what you do is you go through that current profile and you do a risk assessment. And it's funny though, because even before you get to that risk assessment phase, as soon as you write your current profile, like your current answer, you immediately your brain goes, oh my God, I know a better way to do that, or oh, we should be doing this. And what that translates to is after that risk assessment, you're supposed to create a target profile, right? Which is where you want to be. So it was just funny because it was really difficult to not jump to that next step before the risk assessment in the middle.
You say conducting the risk assessment, so that sort of gave you a sense of where you are, sort of your current as-is state as you were documenting it?
Right. That gives you your as-is, and then you kind of – then you list out your – and I don't want to call it a dream state because you don't want to go pie in the sky, but I told my team, you know, if we were to take this to the next level, what would it look like for each of those subcategories?
So that's a really good. So say the categories then one more time and the subcategories just to, for our listeners and for me just to catch up here. So identify.
Sure. So the function is identify. The category is asset management. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the first subcategory for asset management, it's IDAM-1. And it's
okay.
Physical devices and systems within the organization are inventoried.
When you looked at your sort of current profile in that sort of area, those practices, that sort of helped you identify where you were today.
Right. We went through and we listed out all the various systems and policies related to that practice here at the university. And that was summarized in a narrative form with supporting documentation in our current profile.
Okay, that's great. And then what happened?
And then, you know, based on writing that and based on risk assessment as well as kind of just common sense best practices, we then had to go through the target profile exercise. And so taking that same subcategory as an example, you know, so we listed all these different systems that were meeting this practice of physical devices and systems are inventoried and supporting policies, but we recognized that through the current profile that it was multiple systems, they weren't talking to each other, there was a lot of room for potential error, and it was supported by various groups within Central IT's standard operating procedure, not a larger policy. So
okay.
Then the current profile becomes, you know, we need to design a way to do this in at least a grouping of systems that interact with each other and are done under a single standard operating procedure within the department governing the inventory of assets, right?
So then thinking about your target profile, what are some of the actions that you took then after you identified your as-is state then to think about what your target profile should be?
There is a crosswalk to other control families, other frameworks, and so some of it we did turn and look at those, like look at what, you know, for that specific example, you know, what COBIT controls were listed, what ISO controls were listed, what the 853 have to say about that, and then also just knowing our environment, knowing our risk tolerance, knowing the culture here, you know, in terms of how we build things, how we manage things, you know, just how would we want to take that to the next level? And that became what our current profile, you know, for that specific subcategory was. And then we went all the way down the list, took our first stab at that, but then we had to go back to the stakeholders. In this case, it was other IT directors within the central IT organization and say, you know, are we out of our mind? You know what I mean? Like, is this something that we can accomplish in under the best circumstances or under the worst circumstances? And there was some editing that went on. There was some, you know, security had to give a little, some of the departments had to give a little to come up with kind of that desired state, what that would look like. And then the important thing to remember, though, is that entire desired state, that whole current profile, the idea isn't that, I mean, that's where you want to get, but obviously, you know, we talked, you know, there's 98 subcategories. We can't do all that day one, so you have to really go through and do a prioritization, and it is from that prioritization that we got our kind of list of to-dos, right, and then proceeded from there.
So can you say more about that prioritization process and sort of how the discussions went with some of the other groups in your organization? Because it sounds like there's a lot of good stuff in the NIST CSF.
The NIST CSF as it is by itself is purely a qualitative exercise. So it doesn't give you the ability to, you know, you can't put it in a heat map or anything like that and kind of see, you know, where, you know, visually where you need to address. So you have to do it. We took it function by function and we looked at, you know, of the gaps between our current and target profile in this function, in identify, you know, what presents the most risk to the university. And I'll be honest, some of it was, and what is the most, you know, what is some low-hanging fruit that still provides value that's also, you know, in this list. And then we prioritize that. And we did that for each of the functions to kind of come up with the hit list of, you know, what we were going to work on next.
So what were some of your early successes or results by doing that?
really most of it was taking existing practices and streamlining them, documenting them a little bit better. In some cases, you know, like in the case of the asset management, making sure that we already had a system of record that was, you know, enshrined in policy as a system of record, but not, you know, not wasn't being as used like it necessarily should. So going through and fixing that. Other things were expanding programs. For example, our vulnerability management programs, both at for web applications and for hosts. Taking them from kind of an ad hoc, on demand type of thing, and turning them into a more robust, repeatable, continuous program.
I was just going to say that sounds like it could add a lot of value to your cybersecurity program across the diverse environment you have.
Absolutely, absolutely, and you know, doing it at phase one was doing it at like, you know, this enterprise level, but I always recognize that, you know, we're just a piece of the puzzle, right? I know, a big piece, but still a piece of the puzzle. But I have, you know, even though I'm in central IT, I have responsibility for the security across the entire university. So we have all these departmental IT groups that have, you know, workstations, in some cases servers that are still on campus or servers that they're managing at our network operations center. And they have a lot of risk there, too. So I had to... I knew from day one that I was going to have to come up with a way to make this CSF exercise at the enterprise level bubble down to the departmental level.
Okay, great. So then thinking about all that you've told us today, what advice would you have for someone who wants to use the NIST cybersecurity framework to manage their cybersecurity risk? How can they get started, and what might advice would you give them?
I would definitely encourage it. We're a big believer here of the CSF, mainly because it allows communication of cyber risk up, down, and across the organization, and because it is so descriptive and not prescriptive. So in terms of what to do, obviously first, you know, you want to go to the NIST CSF website, download the framework. It's still in its first version, but also on that website, and this is one of the cool things about the CSF is that it's evolving. Just like the current and target profile documents that we created are a living document, we're constantly updating them, specifically every quarter. The CSF is still evolving too. So NIST has on the CSF page, they actually have a roadmap so you can kind of get an understanding of the key areas of development, alignment, and collaboration. And you can have, because of that collaboration, you can actually have a hand in that. So, you know, just taking the CSF and reading it and figuring out how you, I mean, ideally you would just pick up and create a target and current profile. That said, that might not be as easy for all organizations. And so DHS actually has what they call their C-Cubed voluntary program. It's a critical infrastructure cyber community voluntary program. They have an on-site and a self-guided, what they call their cyber resilience review, which is based on the RMM, but also maps to the NIST CSF, and so they have a lot of great resources that, again, either on-site or self-guided that can help an organization kind of go through this process. And they also hold, and I attend these, they hold, I believe it's quarterly, calls where different groups from the critical infrastructure sectors kind of come together and discuss. Usually there's a couple presentations. I think the last one I saw was someone from the energy sector presenting on how they were adapting the NIST CSF to kind of their sector and how that's going to flow down to all the individual, you know, companies that make up that sector.
It sounds like then the NIST cybersecurity framework can be used alongside other frameworks and things that you have. Were you using any other frameworks, or have you since added any frameworks to your use of the NIST cybersecurity framework to address your diverse environment?
We weren't using, and we had looked at other frameworks and kind of to determine how we could apply them to the university. But what we realized is as they existed by themselves, we were going to have to do some extreme hybridization of those frameworks to be able to fit into all the nooks and crannies that is the University of Pittsburgh. That said, though, the CSF does lend itself for mashups with almost anything. And a great example of this is There's a regulatory group, I think it's the FFIEC, for the financial industry, mashed up the cybersecurity framework with their existing security documentation. And the cool thing about it was, and you remember earlier I said I had to figure out how do I get this enterprise activity down at the department level, and then really from when I say things like that, what I mean is how do I do it scalably, right? Because I only have a certain number of people in security that, you know, and I can't send them, you know, abandon all their duties to go do the CSF exercise with, you know, 200 different departments. What this group did is they did this mashup, and for each of those subcategories, they gave, like, acceptable answers. They did 1 through 5. I'm going to do 1 through 4. And what that allowed is turning the CSF into a quantitative exercise as opposed to just a qualitative exercise. So that's actually what we're working on now, to push down a self-service tool to the departments to use. And it's just an example of kind of the flexibility of the CSF and the fact that it's still kind of living and breathing itself, which I honestly think is kind of the purpose of it, right? You know,
right.
It's you know, strengthen the cybersecurity of critical infrastructure across the United States, you know. And so it's not rigid at all, so it allows people to adopt it and, you know, make it their own, but still we're all speaking the same language.
Sure. So that descriptive quality you described, you know, that actually seems to me like it would be a really good way to talk about, you know, to raise the bar, so to speak, to talk to people about all the different kinds of things they should think about when managing cybersecurity risks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, like I said, it allows you to communicate with the same language up and down an organization, but also, you know, ideally across an organization. And for someone like a university where, you know, education is in its own critical infrastructure sector, but we play in almost all of the other critical infrastructure sectors, right? So it'll allow us to talk to, hopefully, the NIH with the same language. It'll allow us to talk to FERC with the same language, you know, and any other, you know, it doesn't even have to be a government organization. It can be, you know, any of the groups that we work with. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. All right, so then where can our listeners learn more? Is there any follow-up activities that you would recommend?
In addition to the NIST CSF website, there's the site for that that CQ program, and there's also the crosswalk that I mentioned is actually on US CERT's website, and I think that will really, for security people out there that are used to working with these other, you know, frameworks and control groups, that'll really kind of drive the message home of how the CSF kind of fits into the larger picture.
Thank you so much. So, Sean, is there anything else you want to tell our listeners before we close out the conversation today?
No, just that I highly encourage people to, even if you're working with something else, take a look at the CSF, see if you can make use of it. It's not the most time-consuming of exercises compared to a lot of the other work we do in security. And most importantly, if you have comments and I'll be a salesperson for NIST for a second. If you have comments and feedback, you know, get that to NIST because they're really looking for that. So, and, you know, that's about all I got to say on it.
Well, thank you so much.